horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, LeaderShield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the races with Steve Bick. Racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Second half on this, exactly second half, actually. 10:30. 90 minutes in, 90 to come. Sid Fernando, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. And Sid joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just looking at some of the results from the sale up here, and kind of, I thought there was some interesting things that went on in here. Said in terms of weanlings. I mean, you had 175 weanlings cataloged, all New York breds, and yeah, quite a few came out, but. The results were kind of all over the board, and we did see some stallions that, you know, are going to, you know, as we get to next year into the yearling market, some of these first crop types that we've been touching on, in fact, you know, through the fall, and volatile, and volatile in particular had a hatful of them, and I thought this was interesting. And then there's the ones of personal interest like Leah Frick. I'm intrigued by the reception that weanlings get.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big feature of fall sales when you get to, you know, obviously in Kentucky, Phasic Tipton in November, and then you get into the Keeneland November sale. But the weanlings that are in those sales, Steve, are pretty much chosen by, you know, maturity and more of a finished product. What you saw with the weanlings the other day was just a more hit-and-miss group of weanlings, people just putting them in there, right?
Sure.
And that's why you have such a different kind of response to them. Besides it being more regional, they're not specifically chosen as weanlings in a lot of cases. It's just, you know, they're put in. So you have, you know, so you can see some developmental physical, you know, the physical parts there are going to be really more stark. If you go to the Kentucky weanling sales, particularly the first, you know, parts of the sales, they're weaning specifically chosen for this, where a breeder or a consigner will think that, you know, there's not going to be too much of a differential in what I sell as weanling now versus holding with the risk for next year as a yearling. And so a lot of the more standout weanlings fall into that category.
You had $350,000 purchases, and the Vekoma colt that was late in the sale, a first foal out of a Smiling Tiger mare, and you know, Vekoma's babies are, these are his first foals. There was a Not This Time filly Christophe Clement bought also fairly late, 150, and the Malibu Moon. This is Malibu Moon's last crop that is going to start to track, also 150. And I mentioned the McLean's Music because, as it happens, let's see, that would have been early in the day. It's kind of funny. The Reeves bought a McLean's Music filly probably before the race was run at Finger Lakes, and then they go out and they win with their McLean's Music 2-year-old. They win the Futurity, but they got their eye on a Futurity in 2 years with another McLean's Music.
Yeah,
40,000.
What did that one bring? 140, right?
140.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, he's a stallion that stands for $50,000 at Hillendale. He's got, you know, Jackie's Warrior this year, and you know, there's been a significant breeding pattern with him too, which is really interesting, and it kind of follows through for their horse Acoustic Ab, who won. You know, let me pull his pedigree up. I think I have it here. Yeah. If you look at Acoustic Ab, you'll notice that the second dam is by Mineshaft, you know, an APND Seattle Slough Line mare. And one of the big things with McLean's Music, as it was with his own sire, Distorted Humor, is that the Seattle Slough Line has played a really important role in the mayor's, some of the most successful McLean's Music winners. So Acoustic Ab, I just pointed out, has the second dam by Mineshaft, who's by AP Indy Seattle Slough, obviously. Jackie's Warrior is by a AP Indy staff, by a mare, out of a mare by an AP Indy stallion called AP 500, who's by AP Indy Seattle Slough. Cloud Computing, who is McLean's Music's first crop Preakness winner, is out of a AP Indy mare. Another grade one winner, Complexity, has Seattle Slough in his pedigree too, because the second dam is by Digression, the son of Seattle Slough. So if you actually tabulate everything, Steve, it's a stunning figure. He's got 11 black type winners that have Seattle Slough in the pedigree, including those three grade one winners I just pointed out to you. Now, Acoustic Avenue has it as well. This particular one you're pointing out, I don't think does he have it or not? I'm not sure. That's in McLean's Music out of a Warriors Reward there, right? And, you know, maybe it's in there somewhere. I'm just looking at the catalog page that, you know, it doesn't show the...
Warriors Reward mare, then a Storm Boot. Second dam is a Storm Boot mare.
Yeah, so it doesn't seem to have the Seattle Slough in it. not that it's necessary, but it was just a interesting thing.
It's an emerging.
I wanted to point out.
Yeah. An emerging concept.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll tell you, speaking of the sale, though, big news, you know, actually related to you as well as for Newsworthy, was the Uncle Mo Stallion King for a Day.
Yep.
You know, the price there was pretty amazing, $130,000, also purchased by the Reeves. And this is a interesting concept because he's a stakes winner. You know, he was brought into New York after Leo Ban was had succeeded and had gotten moved to Kentucky on the heels of the success of Nyquist and Outwork in Kentucky and some other regional successes like Uncle Lino. But these Uncle Mo Stallions, people are on them for good reason, too. And you, of course, have a yearling by Motown. And Motown is, you know, for a later developing horse in terms of, you know, running a distance and got a grade one win late in the year three. He also has a bunch of winners right now and some really high quality wins. Success begets success, and here there's a big following right now, King for a Day.
I'm glad you brought him up, and that one out of a Sky Mesa mare, Downtown Daria herself out of a Tour d'Or mare. They're also, and I'm glad you mentioned Complexity, because here's a son of McLean's Music already, you know, getting a chance at stud, and the first three babies that he sent through the ring, $100,000. Glenn Crest bought Hip 179. The Reeves again strike, this time for a colt Hip 54 for $85,000. And there was one a colt at the end of the sale that Bolter Bloodstock bought for $13,000. He stands for 12.5 at Airdrie. And so here's the first foals of Complexity, and that's a question in and of itself as well, Sid. How well does that reflect on McLean's Music and generate even more interest in McLean's Music as a stallion that, you know, that he's got a son standing at stud in relatively short order, and of course, you know, the next thing that's going to happen is Jackie's Warrior.
Yeah, and he also has cloud computing, that Preakness winner from his first crop with his first juveniles this year as well. Complexity was, you know, a sprinter like Jackie's Warrior, who's, you know, from what I hear, extremely sought after, would be naturally as the high-quality horse he was. It seems that another one of John Sikora's, you know, improbable plays, which is that McLean's Music made one start, sensational maiden victory, fabulous time, didn't run again, went to Hillendale with one win from one start, standing for $6,500. And from his first crop, he gets a classic winner, just like Gunrunner, the Preakness winner. Except he's at the other end of the stud feed spectrum. And, you know, worked his way up. He's at $50,000 now. He's got Jackie's Warrior, Complexity, another grade one winner. We've discussed this. And he's on the verge of you know, with all these good sons, having his sons go to stud. So, you know, you've got a chance for yet another line of distorted humor on the male line through, you know, a non-stakes winning son in McLean's Music. Now, McLean's Music, by the way, he'd been bought out of the sale by Stone Street for like $900,000 or $950,000. They bred the horse, and they RNA'd him. That was a hell of a reserve to put and bring it back. Looked like they knew he had obviously he showed that talent in his first win, but unfortunately he didn't go on as a stakes winner. But they, you know, they stayed with him, and now he's proving to be quite a really good stallion.
Sid, let me hit on a couple of, I'm going to throw a couple at you, and none of this was scripted, but, you know, just going through the results, and one thing I did not notice on Monday that I subsequently saw was what has to be considered a very good sale for Honest Mischief.
Yeah. Well, he's going to be one of those horses, Steve, that he's by Into Mischief. He's from a Judmon family. And he was the horse that was taken as a replacement for Sequel when Laoban was sent to Kentucky, pretty much. This line, of course, is the, you know, is the flavor of the day, Into Mischief. And this horse, you know, with the Judmon family behind him, and I don't know how many he had. I know a bunch of them that he had in the sale were withdrawn, but he had quite a few. Again, I think he only stands for, you know,
$6,500.
Yeah. So, you know, he's had, you know, what was his most expensive? I think like an $80,000.
Big Bear Bloodstock, yeah. Bought the one out of Force Majeure, Hip 113. But what was notable was just that, you know, the ones that did go through the ring, here's $15,000 private sale. Clement bought a filly for $55. Final Furlong bought one for $65. Sapphire Stables, $35. The aforementioned Big Bear, $80. Asila Partners, $37,000. $15, $28, $35. That's a nice sell-through.
All great returns when you think about it, that they're weanlings. They were just the foal this year, right?
Yeah, so exactly.
You don't have to add the added cost of carrying that foal as a yearling. So, those were really excellent returns. And he's kind of been a buzz horse in New York, right? So, and Becky Thomas does a tremendous job. And he's the type of horse that has the the chance. He's set up with that type of pedigree to be able to go to Kentucky if he hits. I mean, that's what happened to Leo Frick as well. Don't forget Candy Ride, Grade One winner.
Well, and we've got our Leo Frick colt that is out at the farm. I'm going to also throw you Higher Power and Global Campaign. Global Campaign had two really nice successes.
100,000.
Yeah, 100,000, yeah. And what was the other one? 100,000 and 75,000. And then there was a one RNA for 31.
And you know, these are all excellent prices for the highlights that we're bringing up. you know, Global Campaign is another Curlin, by the way. Speaking of the AP Indy relationship with McLean's Music, AP Indy has such an incredible relationship with Curlin, and Global Campaign is a G1 winner, stands at Windstar, by Curlin, out of an AP Indy mare. That's bred, that breeding is the same as, you know, you look at all your good, just don't even look historically, just take a look at your best Curlins this year. Let's take a look at how they're all bred, for example. I'm just going to pull it up so that I don't miss one. But, you know, Nest, Malifat, let's see. I don't want to say him without pulling this up here, but okay, yeah. Malifat, out of an AP Indy mare, okay? Nest, out of an AP Indy mare, just like this horse, Global Campaign. First Captain, out of an AP Indy mare. Now, go to the grade one winner, Cody's Wish, out of a Tappet mare. Of course, Tappet Pulpit, AP Indy. A Clarier, grade one winner, out of a Bernardini by AP Indy mare. Elite Power, grade one winner of grade two winner of the Vosburgh, out of a Vindication mare, same Seattle Sioux line. Cezanne, the ill-fated Cezanne who died this year, out of a Bernardini by AP Indy, right? How astounding is that cross right there? And so, you know, it plays really well when you have that type of breeding. You have the grade one win behind you, and you've got a first crop weanling selling. And that's, you know, bred in New York.
That's why I thought this was well worth monitoring, these first offerings. And you know, in some cases, I'm sure it's people that are trying to get out ahead of opportunity. I'm going to throw one more. Volatile, who has come up almost every week, it seems.
And he's a real... I saw him when I went to Three Chimneys, remember, to see Gunrunner a few weeks ago. Boy, what a outstanding... physical specimen he is, and, you know, a top level sprinter. I think he was like an $850,000 yearling or something like that. You know, extremely fast horse. He's a horse I really like, and of course he's by Violence, who's really in the spotlight this year with Forte. Except Volatile is kind of that profile that Violence had established early on at Desire, really good sprinters. You know, he had that horse, No Parole. And so forth. Known as a early Desire sprinters. He started off his stud career really great. It just so happens we're talking about these Hillendale sires, doesn't it? Because we just talked about Curlin, McLean's Music, and now Violence is Volatile. Hillendale happens to sponsor your show, but I had no idea when we were just talking about it that it was all going to come back to that. But
yeah, exactly. It kind of just bubbled to the surface. And also, frankly, we can tie this point with Volatile to what we brought up last week, and that is the resurgence and the way Three Chimneys has, I don't want to say been resurrected, but certainly has returned to prominence between
you know, Gunrunner being the engine on the train, Sharp Azteca, the surprise of the year, and Volatile coming up behind him. And they also still have the, you know, the venerable Sky Mesa, who is a favorite of people like Jack Oxley. And
right.
Yeah, Palace Malice is there. The Repatriated Will Take Charge. And Fantastic. A more than ready that has every right to catch a wave.
You know, it's interesting because you brought up Palace Malice because he got that grade one winner structure in his first crop. And, you know, as is usually the case with these types of horses, you know, they kind of go silent for a little while because subsequent crops aren't as strong as that first crop. But I'll tell you something. I was just, you know, we were at the day job at Work Derby Consultants. We've been, you know, going, we went through the phase except in October sale. And one of the things that struck me going through that sale was how good the mare, well, the yearlings by Palace Malice are in terms of pedigree. Palace Malice yearlings in that sale probably have some of the strongest pedigrees I've seen, which could be a really good sign for next year that these horses, you know, they started to get good pedigrees after his first crop hit with structure. And, you know, speaking of Curlin, Palace Malice is the son of Curlin. And, you know, with the kind of year Curlin's having, I have a feeling that next year and the next couple of years, you're going to see a bit of a resurgence in Palace Malice based on what I saw with these mares. Extraordinarily strong for that type of horse. So it's something I'm going to keep an eye on for sure, because you could find some surprising resurgence here with him.
It's a great story, and the Three Chimneys, certainly a venerable farm. In the industry, and kind of speaks. I know we've had this conversation, Sid, in lots of guises, and you've talked about Torrealba before. But it kind of speaks to the cyclical nature and how the introduction of new money and new partners or investors or those that acquire farms and breathe life into them and help sustain them. It's a theme. It's actually a theme that's repeated, for generations of breeding. It's not a new phenomenon. It's gone on forever. But it's certainly great to. Yes, there's the Overbrooks that go away, but it's great to have Three Chimneys and Calumet, and we've hit on this over the years many times.
Yeah, and Torrealba, it's really interesting because it just so happens that when Torrealba, who's Brazilian, was first getting into the business, one of the first horses he had, and so this dates me and him, but it was in the early, '90s, I believe. I happened to be in a BA, Buenos Aires, for the Pellegrini. And he was there, and the bloodstock agent, his Brazilian bloodstock agent at the time, Renato Gamero, who used to be based in Lexington, had purchased a horse for him from a field and he only paid $3,000 for that horse. Renato did. He was a beautiful horse. He loved the horse. He named him much better. Toriyama named him much better. And that horse ended up winning Pellegrini. And I happened to go up to Torrealba's table at the time when in the clubhouse. So I met Toriyama for the first time there. He's just a young guy. I think, you know, I don't know if it was his first horse, but one of his first horses. And so from there onwards, his career really took off. And it's really interesting because in a few years later, he owned a horse called Much Better in this country. It was a Pioneer of the Nile. He bought three chimneys. Bred the horse, and you know, I think he raced him originally. He named that horse Much Better after his really good horse that he had had, you know, years ago in Brazil. And you know, while he was in Brazil, the other part about Toriyama that people might have forgotten is he raced as the entity Stud TNT.
Right.
And as he was coming up, one of the things he did was at the Calumet Dispersal, he bought the Devil's Red and Blue Silks of Calumet. And that's one of the reasons why Brad Kelly doesn't run under those historic Calumet Silks. And neither did Henrik de Fiatkowski. It was Toriyama who bought those silks, and they were the silks of Stud TNT in Brazil. And then when he raced here, he originally raced in those original Calumet silks too. I think he might have modified them now for, like, for Gunrunner and some of his horses here. But that's a little interesting anecdote about him that you know, kind of ties in with the history of racing in this country too.
Absolutely, and a lot of people I know had hoped that there was going to be a way that, you know, that the Devil's Red and Blue could, you know, could somehow shift. But frankly, the black with the gold chevrons that Brad Kelly races with, that jacket's come to its own prominence, actually. So
it has, and now we're used to that. We're used to that.
Well, Sid.
Hello.
We're here. Sid, I appreciate it, and we'll. This was impromptu, and we got a lot of ground covered. And when it comes to everybody planning, I mean, we're inching closer and closer. It's October, folks. So your decision making, you're now. In fact, it's the middle of October. So middle of November, middle of December, middle of January. We're about 120 days away from the opening of the stallion barns and the covering of mares, and work with Sid and Roger, work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. Get out in front of this because they're going to get very busy.
Oh, yeah. I do need to tell you right now that I appreciate the plug, but I do want to say that we're probably running about 3 weeks, you know.
You're piled up already.
Yeah. So, just,
all right.
Just as a warning.
Well, and so it's good advice for people that are hearing. Get out ahead of it. Get your mares submitted to Sid and let them put them in the queue. And, you know, we're going to get closer to Breeders' Cup, and obviously we'll be focused on that. But it's always valuable, Sid, for us to let you riff on the contents of the
compatibility report, and you are not going to have a more comprehensive evaluation of your mare from every angle, from commercially or whether you're going to breed to sell or breed to race, and then an array of suggestions for the various price points. It's just an invaluable tool to help you decide, and sometimes it sort of takes you by the hand and leads you in a certain direction. It'll become self-evident by the way in which Sid and Roger write up the analysis and make it clear to you, what your best option is. So broodmare compatibility
that's a great explanation.
That's my job.
Excellent.
Sid, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, great talking to you. See you.
Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill and Dale, Johnson Cures, Alapa. And I'm looking forward to getting to Alapa. I'm looking forward to getting to Andy Serling, who's standing by. And I think he's still in Saratoga. I don't think he's on the train. So it'll be easier. Because much like that conversation with Rick Schosberg the other day when he was on the Taconic, there's certain places when you're driving from Saratoga to downstate to the island or to the city, there's certain places that are just just black holes. No matter how even on the thruway where there's towers and they do their best for coverage, there's still little spots where it just signal just drops, fades away. The Taconic's tougher because it's up and down and over hill and dale, literally. So Andy's going to join us, and we'll touch on some of the New York action. I've not actually looked at Aqueduct tomorrow. I should really at least get a glance. Maybe I've got today's Keeneland and tomorrow. I've also got Indy, and the racing at Indy continues to be terrific on a daily basis, and they're also doing nice business. They continue to do nice business. Looking forward, by the way, speaking of some of the regional venues, Remington, big weekend ahead, so we're looking forward to catching up with Dale Day, and they drew the classics cards, and let me see. They wouldn't have, not going to have morning lines or the master lists up, but you can certainly look ahead to Friday, and I should probably get we should get Dale in tomorrow so that we're a day ahead. To look at the Oklahoma Classics card, and I'll, in fact, I should probably get that card printed up. You've got starts about 8 o'clock on Friday night, and a couple of starters, and then things get serious at about 9:05 with the Lassie. The Lassie and the Juvenile, the Distaff Turf, the Distaff on the main track, the Sprint. You got the Classic Cup, of course, for everybody going, the top Oklahoma breds going a mile and a 16th, and the Turf Classic as well. So very nice stake card on Friday night at Remington to look forward to. All right, I'm gonna start it with the. Let me see about the, as we wait for Andy. See about the wagering. Where the, you got to pick five starts in the sixth through the tenth. Nice betting menu. Andy Serling joins us. Good morning.
Morning. This is really exciting for me.
Why?
To be on your return show. I mean, I think a lot of people were worried after yesterday. Could be the end for Steve. It's been a rough month.
Was
for you.
Well, I was only sick a day. It wasn't like...
Yeah, I know, but one day for you could, you know, given all the travails you've been through over the last few weeks, all the narrow misses and the close brushes, it'd be inevitable. And then again, well, it's every night where Tina could suffocate you in your sleep, getting through all of those. So well, it's good to have you back.
Well, and Andy's alluding to something that I did not make particularly public, but brush with death. There you go.
He had a very, very serious hangnail, and Tina and I discussed, you know, just putting an end to it. Reasonable. Anyway, how are you, Steve? Feeling better? Got your voice back?
My voice is okay. I'll fade a little bit here. I think the last hour, but no, this is the same thing that happened when Tina and I, when she first moved in, and her first school year, she literally came home from school, right at the beginning of the season, the school year, and I got sick immediately because she was bringing home, you know, kid germs, and this was grandchildren germs. I get it now.
So first you're going to be picking on the children that she's trying to teach, and now you're picking on her grandchildren.
Well, they're my grandchildren,
so
too.
Really,
come on.
Where is this going? I mean, who's next? Seriously, who's going after next?
UNICEF. UNICEF is my next target.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. She's taking on a really ugly tone. After you went 0-for-3 on the movie quiz yesterday, I think you'd be a little more humbled.
Well, you know what? You could have put that up. I mean, you concentrate on polls.
No.
Why are your polls? Your polls don't all have to be horse related.
Nobody cares about my other crap, really.
That's not true.
Seven people do.
No. You're the one years ago who taught me and said to me, you know, don't ever steer away from a slightly obscure reference or something, you know, funny, because there'll be somebody out there that'll enjoy it.
I didn't say that wasn't true, but I don't really have much to say about anything else at this point.
Come on. You know,
John Irving book is 900 pages long.
900?
The problem with 900-page books is that many read in transit, though. So I guess I could be like people that get like a, you know, an iPad or whatever that thing is, but I like books. I'm not buying an 900-page book.
What's his latest?
Something that I was reading the review of the Times today. I don't know what it's called. Like, I'm not
going to. The Last Chairlift.
Yeah, I'm thinking that there really hasn't been much since A Widow for 1 Year, right?
Honestly, I walked away. You know, I read Garp, and we all loved Garp. Then the Cider House Rules, I could not get through.
I love Cider House Rules. I loved Widow for 1 Year. The Widow for 1 Year was great.
Yeah.
But ever
Owen Meany, right?
Hotel New Hampshire. Widow for 1 Year was that good movie that they made from part of it, with Jeff Bridges and Kim Basinger. The Door on the Floor.
I have not gone back to the well there for years.
Steve, what's the last book you actually read?
That's a good question, actually.
I am reading a very good book that actually correlates to horse racing, in theory, called The Success Equation, Untangling Skill and Luck in Business, Sports, and Investing.
Okay. This is an interesting topic, actually.
Yeah, I've only read about, I don't know, it's not that long. It's a little over 200 pages. I've read about 50 or 60 pages. It's just about, you know, the concept of, you know, skill and luck. You know, what, you know, people confusing one for the other. I think that is something I think about in racing a lot. You know, just because you like a horse and it wins, were you right? And just because you like a horse and it lost, were you wrong? And I think, you know, we're all so quick, myself included, sometimes, you know, say, oh, I made a great pick, I just got unlucky, which sometimes you do, that we don't really notice when we won and maybe we were a little lucky, you know? We don't notice the bad trips that others had. You know, is it possible you actually like the third best horse and, you know, a number of things happened that, you know, I mean, let's, you know, if you like a horse because you think it's the only speed and you think it can wire the field, and it ends up closing from eighth to win. Did you make a smart pick? Well, maybe
some
you
found
the best horse, but it didn't exactly win for the reasons you thought the horse could win. Because we've all bet horses that we thought were going to go to lead.
That's true.
That rated and won. I mean, you know, there's never you never have to apologize for betting winners, but I think it's not a question what you're doing publicly. It's a question what you're doing personally and intrinsically. And I think anybody who's seriously handicapping or playing, you know, betting should constantly be introspective about the decisions they make. You know, it's too many people think I was right, you know, or I, you know, and sort of pound your chest. I don't know why anybody would do that, but you know, it depends. I mean, I'll give you an example of that ridiculous 3.5 year layoff horse that won on Saturday at Aqueduct. Paid 560. That horse got a 60 buyer and won. So I think part of the question becomes, was it reasonable to expect that a 60 buyer would win that race? And, you know, forgetting about whether you thought it was reasonable that horse would run a 60 buyer. If it did you really think that horse was likely to win? 9 to 5 the right price to take? I don't know. You know, I think there's a lot of things that it can never hurt to be introspective, especially as a handicapper and a player, as a player in the game, to ask yourself what you did right and what you did wrong. You have a chance of fixing the things you're doing wrong if you do that. You have no chance of fixing the things we all do wrong all the time if you're not taking that approach.
Well,
and skill and luck is an important factor.
Well, and this is a terrific topic, and I'm going to ask you to juxtapose.
Maybe.
Well, no, it is, and you've touched on it in various guises, probably as much as anybody over the years on the show.
Or disguises.
Part of the problem is people being honest with themselves.
Well, that's true of all of us and everything we do, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, I mean, if you're not honest with yourself about anything you're doing, then you know, you're never going to get it right. You might think you're getting it right because you're not honest with yourself, but of course, no question about it. You know, I mean, the importance of your opinion, it's hard. You know, there's something, I don't know if it was, I think it was in this or somewhere else I was reading about modeling, you know, and obviously modeling's become a big topic of discussion, sports betting, things like that. And how hard it is for an individual to make a model without incorporating their own personal biases into it. So if you're making a model and it incorporates biases that you have, then it's not really going to be an effective model. It's going to be an effective model that's kind of telling you what you want to hear. And I'm not saying there's an easy answer to it. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, great at not doing it. I mean, I think we all try to do that. And it's a tricky thing to do because you develop relationships in life. I'm good friends with Seth Carvin, and so I want the Carvish horses to do well. It's easier for me because so many of them seem to be short prices that it's easier to pick against them because they're always underlaid anyway because people are overbetting Chad Brown horses. But, you know, you want them to win, but you try to find a way that you're being unbiased. And sometimes I think I lean the other way. You know what I mean? It's like I want to bet against them and, you know, trying to figure out what price is the fair price. And then, you know, you'll see with a trainer, you say they're habitually overbet, and then you look up, and they have a prolonged, you know, $2-plus ROI in something, and I'm thinking, how overbet are they? They're showing a positive ROI with a significant number of starters. I feel like they're overbet, but I can't be right, because if a trainer's winning at, you know, 30% with something, and a 210 ROI with 120 starters, they're not overbet. They're arguably underbet. And I think we all have those, you know, friends of ours that own horses, friends of ours that are trainers, you know, things,
yep.
Wanting to see people do well. Friendly with a rider who's going through a bad streak. You want to see them win a race, right? I mean, it's hard. We all, you know, we accrue as we go along, we accrue more and more potential bias, you know, personal bias potholes, right?
Agreed.
And works both ways. Overly trying to see them do well and sometimes, you know, thinking, I need to, you know, I shouldn't pick this guy because he's my friend, you know? It's hard. I don't think there's an absolute answer. I know there isn't. I know it's impossible to be completely unbiased as a human being.
Agreed. And then there's also the I don't know how you would term this. I'm sure there is a term for it, but the expectation element about including scenarios or individual horses or connections in certain spots because you know that they or you have a mental impression anecdotally that well this guy always beats me in these spots so
well,
I'm
that's,
gonna
that's dumb. I mean that
I know that's what I'm saying
know,
that,
I find
that's a
I,
blind
I find,
alley
you know, what do you do with insurance horses you know horses you feel like oh I bet that horse twice and they need a big price today and you know I'm gonna
yep.
be sick of the horse wins
exactly
yeah I find making you're better off making a tiny win bet on the horse and getting it out of your head or something they never win or almost never win those horses it depends. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't. There's a whole lot of, you know, minutiae, personal biases, stupid things that you sort of can't get out of the way of. It's like, oh, I don't want that guy to beat me. Yeah, I mean, you have to get past that to a certain extent. But I think part of it is saying, what is the reason I'm using this horse, you know? And I think a lot of bad information gets thrown around by this notion of, you know, using horses because they're favored. No, nobody smart is using a horse because they're favored. But to disregard the fact that the odds over time, X takeout, horses runs them over time is foolish. And in other in sequences where you're honing in on a big price in one of the four legs, it's never going to be smart to have left out a logical horse in another leg. Because you're trying to make yourself have to be too smart to win the bet. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? I'm trying to make money when X horse wins this, you know, ABCD leg of the race. So I'm not going to focus on being clever in another leg of the race. You know? But teach their own. And I think the question you have to ask yourself of your approach is, do I actually win doing it? Or I just pretend I win on Twitter. Or to myself. I mean, we all lie to ourselves. We all lie to ourselves about lots of things, right?
Yep.
Human nature.
Yep.
And nowhere is it going to become more important to be honest with yourself than gambling. Because your results will, you know, ultimately, a lot of people may go to the track or go to casinos or even betting on sports because they enjoy it. Which is fine, and they're going to lose a little bit, and that's fine. But in essence, we're talking about trying to be successful or be less unsuccessful. So, you know, your proof's in the pudding. If you're just making mistakes, you can lie to yourself all you want. You're still going to lose money.
I want you to shift gears slightly, and
sure.
I want you to juxtapose two maiden winners from recent ripped from today's headlines that came up after Julia Shining's win at Keeneland the other day and came back with a modest fig. And of course, you know, this immediately tied into Justique, the John Sheriff's filly. And
well, I tied Justique.
I know you did.
Okay.
Yes. So this is important, Andy, because there's a real valuable insight to a lot of there's a lot of intersection going on here between these two horses.
Well, I think there's two different conversations here. There's the conversation from nitwits who put labels on people. You have an East Coast bias. You have a West Coast bias. You are a slave to speed figures. You don't believe in speed figures enough. You have to get away from that. You have to get away from that idiocy. Because immediately when somebody says that, I'm not interested in their opinion because they're not listening. But I think it's the same conversation. You have to look at things with a sense of equanimity. The reason that I prefer a buyer speed figure to something like the Thoroughgraphs or the Sheep, and I have nothing but respect for their methodology and what they do. And in no way
do I mean this as a criticism. But there, first of all, for what I'm doing on the air, especially in Talking Horses, is trying to explain racing at a certain level. So those numbers are not going to help me, you know, because they may help. They're shortcuts. And I'm not knocking them, but they're going to, you know, they're taking into effect a lot of information that I can look up and, you know, somewhat subjectively, hopefully subjectively. So I want a raw speed figure, basically a number that makes a decision about based on time. So then you ask yourself, how is a figure earned? And in a lot of racing, it's earned just because that's how good the horse is, good or bad. But in a lot of cases, a pace may have had a big factor. A bias might have played a role. A number of things. And when you looked at a horse like Just Deep, one of the reasons that over the summer that I was suspect of her is that she had earned that number while getting an extremely fast pace to close into. And, you know, one of the many dumb things that people do is use the concept of eye test. I was really impressed with how she did it. Well, yeah, because she got a great setup and it made her look good doing what she does. She's a horse that doesn't have a lot of speed. And in this particular case, she got a very fast pace to close into. She's also a first-time starter for John Sheriffs, who doesn't win with first-time starters and could very easily improve over her career. And I don't discount that possibility. But I don't think that people should have made too much about her debut because she looked so good winning. Because the race was very slow. You didn't even need to look at speed figures to know it was slow. All you need to do is look at her relative time relative to the other times that day. And then a horse like Julia Shining, who got, I think, a 71 and Justique got a 72, so they effectively ran the same buyer speed figure. Julia Shining did it in a race that didn't completely fall apart, and she did it while making a long, extended 4 or 5 wide run around the field. So she did it without the benefit of race dynamics playing in her favor. She essentially was running on her own in a different race. That race didn't fall apart for her to win. She created her own trip. So to me, she ran a much more impressive race. So the fact that they got the same figure, to me, says that the one who made her own trip just ran a much better race. How much do you quantify it? I don't know. I can't really quantify it. I guess, you know, that's something that, you know, once again, the Ragusans, the Thoroughgraphs, and Company, wide into it. You know, and I would also look at Craig's figures at time form and see how he judged her performance based on the pace and things like that. But in a general sense, I think you always want to evaluate a horse performance based on a speed figure, but also with a realistic approach to how that figure was earned. And no serious player that uses a raw speed figure, a buyer-type speed figure, that's serious about the game is just going to say, this horse ran an 80, that horse ran a 76, therefore I know the 80 horse is better. Well, no. I mean, I'll give you an example from this weekend. Let's look at McCulloch versus Gina Romantica at Keeneland. McCulloch was clearly faster, right? She was running about 7-8 fire points faster. On the other hand, Gina Romantica in her race two back, she had had a pace in her favor. She got an excellent trip, and that win was very much a function of pace. And it's one of the reasons that some of us like the horse that she beat when she beat her the next time. Having said that, when she ran against that same horse that was second to her in the risk-averse, in the Pebbles, the horse who won the race, had an ideal circumstance. And Gina Romantica did not. She didn't draw that well, and she had to try to close into a paceless race. And she ran very well to be second. So her subsequent turf effort was a big improvement. So it's not surprising, especially given the perfect trip that she got in the QE2, that she ran 6-7 points better. She also may be improving a little bit. And the fact that McCulloch, you know, drop back a few points. Well, maybe she didn't love cutting back from 1 3/8 to 1 1/8. Maybe she's run a lot this year and she's sort of at the end of the year and the other horse is moving forward and she's not. So it's not that surprising that the gap was closed. And I said it in retrospect. I'm not suggesting I made some score on Gina Romantica because nothing could be farther from the truth. I didn't really bet the race. But I'm just saying that's why in retrospect you can say it's not that surprising that she improved, especially given the trip that she got on Saturday. Not that.
Well, and again, in this case, it ties back to what we were just talking about. The initial reaction that, and of course, you know, what you see on social media is not.
Well,
you
just have to ignore what people say on social media, because, or not, just assume it's wrong, and you'll be fine.
Well, because the immediate aftermath is, oh, it's the other Chad, it's the
right,
other
that,
Pletcher.
All of these people that say the other, whether it's Chad or Todd or Baffert, they always win, right? Do an ROI search study of that, and you'll find out that it's not particularly special. You just seem to notice when the other one wins, right? When the bigger price wins. I don't pay any attention to that, you know. And it's like there's someone that said, big price in a small field. Yeah, whatever.
Well, I did want you.
So, you know, bullshit things that people make up that act like they're realities. And most of the time, it's from people that aren't betting.
Now, and I, Justique, this particular circumstance was really interesting. I mean,
ran effectively the same figure, and there were such polar opposite type trips. And they both closed. But I don't want to think that. I'm knocking Justique. I like John. I always root for John's horses. You know, John was great. I really enjoyed it when he was in New York, and I always like see him do well. And, you know, I think she's probably, if anything, a closing sprinter anyhow. You know, she has a running style of a closing sprinter type. So probably coming back 3 months later or 2.5 months later and running in a two-turn race, probably not what she wants to do, though she did get a fair pace to run into. She's just not. She may not be that good, at least at this point in her career. She may be more effective in six, seven, eight furlong races around one turn or something. I wouldn't give up on her if you're a fan. I just think you have to be careful about overrating after one start under pretty ideal circumstances. The other thing is that people are often seduced by deep closers. I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of people love Zenyatta. It's exciting. There's nothing more exciting than having your horse make this huge run from dead last, right? I mean, that's exciting.
True.
When you bet speed horses, you're spending the entire race hoping they hang on. Right? But when you bet a horse that comes from last, it's exciting. There used to be a harness horse that used to run here in the 70s, a Cerro Harness named Easy Ines, who I had a big affinity for. And he used to come from last, the three-quarter pole. How many horses won races from last, the three-quarter pole, with regularity at the higher level and a track, half-mile track like Cerro Harness? Not that many. It was exciting, you know? That horse you really got pumped up to watch. And I think Zenyatta had that real. I don't mean this. She was a tremendous racehorse, also, but she also was a thrilling horse because she, you know, she constantly seemed to be snatching victory from the jaws of defeat.
Yeah, it is a phenomena that the Silky Sullivan.
It's exciting. I think nothing wrong with that. You know, we like things that excite people, and that's what we love about racing. There was a horse. Chowder's First, I used to like. And I remember Chowder's First winning the Ramon, big gray. One day I made a big bet on him. And I mean, you know, he wasn't even in the pictures there. And I come in the 16th pole. Ghost Zapper, right? In some of those races. And those runs were electrifying.
Man. I appreciate you touching on that. How about a couple of results here from the weekend. I had Shug to talk about Skims. This is
incredible for Shug to get a chance to come on the show with you. I mean, that has got to be, you know, one of the pinnacles in a great career, getting to spend time with you on the radio. Close he came to losing you? Did he take on extra gravity?
Gotta stop.
He didn't know. I mean, there's a lot of people out there. You and I, most people don't know that you and I are in a daily battle with ourselves, not with each other. Skim's got a great ride for Johnny. The fact that Skim was ahead of Vergara in there, you know, in the earlier running was a real difference. And I thought Vergara wasn't ridden with a great sense of urgency by Joel. And Johnny was aggressive. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, some would argue that John blesses, and he has always been a great rider and through his career. But I really think he's ridden extremely well over the last year or so. I think one of the differences is he's doing a very consistent job of getting good position in races. And I, in a race like that, I think it really mattered. And he's made the difference in a lot of these cases. And it was nice for Andrew Rosen to get the win.
Yes.
You know, it's funny, we were talking about it, Pete and I were talking about it off camera. And, you know, and there's, you take for granted what people know or don't know. And I was talking about his father's involvement, Andrew's father. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people necessarily would realize what a big, you know, how involved his father, Andrew's father, was in the game. He owned Chief's Crown. He owned Chris Evert. Hear that Chris Evert lost the Alabama, the Quays Quill, and came back a week later in the slop and ran the Travers, much like, what's her name, did 5 years later, Devoted Dale. And she ran third to the holding pattern in Little Curran. But she was a tremendous horse. That's what she's found. The best horse I thought Andrew ever had was Icon Project. Icon Project?
I remember Icon Project.
Fire winning the personal ends, and unfortunately, I remember they were going to run to the Beldame, and they skipped to go to the Spinster a week later, and I think she had a suspensory injury and had to get retired. She's a very, very, very good horse.
What did you, in addition to the stake conversation, let me see who else that, well, that was a Keeneland. I don't want to throw Keeneland stuff at you.
Because I'm paying zero attention to it, basically. Save, apparently, the two horses we just spent 10 minutes talking about.
Well, everybody was watching that. I mean, that got everybody. Tons of play.
Even my mom was talking about it.
you've had a nice week with your mother.
I always have a nice time with my mom. What's not to like?
Oh, we know what you
Dairy
do have to.
Girl. We watched Dairy Girl on Netflix.
You told me about this.
Dairy Girl. It's extremely funny.
All right.
Really.
How was Amsterdam?
I thought it was interesting. I know the reviews weren't great. I thought it was interesting. I enjoyed it. I like David O. Russell's movies, though.
So do I. And it's a great cast. All right, I'm looking forward to that. Let me, the other horse I've got, a couple of horses I got to ask you about, because we talked to Suge about Signator, and of course it came over a wet track, so it's hard to know.
It went from muddy to fast awfully quickly. I think that track was, there wasn't an enormous amount of moisture in the track, and it was heroin,
right.
So I wouldn't make much of that. I tell you what, it came up a kind of slow race, so I was, you know, disappointed. The figure was in the low 70s. He had looked so promising first time out. I thought he would take another step forward, as Shook's horses often do when they stretch out. Maiden race got great numbers, especially stretching out maiden, second time starter stretching out. You know, and when the price tag is $1.7 million, you have expectations. So while he crushed the field, I'm a little skeptical, given that he didn't really get much faster from his 6-furlong race. Not to say he can't and won't improve over time, as Shook's horses do so frequently, but I was not overly impressed by that performance. I won't be surprised if Shug, you know, keeps him maybe for the, you know, the Rems in one race and give him a shot. Mm-hmm. No reason not to, and he might win it. But I kind of thought he would improve a little bit more. And maybe the one thing you say is the track was changing a bit. It was the first race, so I don't want to be overly harsh about it. And he's obviously a horse with promise in the right hands. But I'm going to take a wait and see approach after that. Not trying to be negative about it, just I kind of expected a little more. But once again, I don't want to, you know, be too conclusive about one race, the first race of the day, track was drying, et cetera, et cetera.
How about earlier on Saturday, and of course, you know, the course had plenty of moisture, but that Evan Harlan, the older maiden winner.
Who? That walked to the front end of the race. It was a total merry-go-round race after failing in three straight races. I don't know, which is okay. But
all right. I just was curious.
I mean, I just wouldn't. You know, Pizza Bianca didn't run badly in the stake. I mean, she was horribly overbet. Anybody who was betting her 9-5 is insane. And I think the question with her is whether or not she's really improved from 2-3. And the jury's still out on that. But I thought, given the dynamics of the race and her post, she ran a credible race running fourth.
interesting to see what they do with her. You know, they're not going to go out to California for that race, the American Oaks. She doesn't seem like a horse that will thrive at more distance. I would think she probably wants a little less distance, if anything. I just think it's, you know, a question whether or not she got better. And I imagine they'll leave her in training as a four-year-old, but I don't know. I don't see any reason not to, but I think it's questionable whether or not she's ever really gotten any better. But it's
all right,
hard
quick
enough,
hit.
Right?
Let me give you a chance for a something. How about tomorrow? How about that sixth race? The State Bred Filly's going a mile on the inner.
Let me look. I have made my picks.
Tomorrow, no, feels like Palace Gossip. Palace Gossip on the lead.
I like to book every cent on her. I booked 10-1 shots. Well, I mean, if Master of the Tunes runs back to her last race, she'll be very tough in here. I don't know if she'll be the 6-1 she is in the morning line. I doubt that, but it's hard to know in this race, you know. I mean, Classic Lady's obviously dropping a lot, but she was awful last time. The tough read race. I think I picked Master of the Tunes, but I'm not sure. I'll tell you something. Oh, that's not okay. The race. Yeah. I didn't think My Lips Are Sealed. It was impossible.
I agree.
I don't think the Palace Lady is the Classic Lady is impossible. Not my kind. I don't think Golden Rock is impossible on the rail.
It's a fun race.
Maybe. Okay.
Anything else from tomorrow that stood out to you?
I like the horse in the eighth race a little bit. He's got it before. Horses has some
Jimmy Ryerson.
Horses has some Jimmy's won a bunch of races recently. I don't know. Sorry. I had to get up early today. I'm a little tired. I got my booster early this morning. Easier to do it in Saratoga.
Oh, good work. Yeah. All right.
No, it's all. No.
When's your train?
Why? Are you going to come meet me?
I was going to ask you for
something. You go to the school with Tina, you get the band together, you bring it over. You're not that far. Train is 157.
In case you're interested. 157. All right, not enough time for lunch.
No, well, I'm having lunch with Bob. Sorry, she takes precedence over you, Steve. Much as I like you. Who's your next guest? What type
Seth
of the industry
Merrow.
Is on? Seth Merrow. Now that's. I don't want you to keep him waiting any longer because I know he has absolutely nothing else to do. So he's probably waiting eagerly. By
Glad you said that. Andy Serling, everybody, and America's Day at the Races returns tomorrow. Look forward to it. And good late action tomorrow at Aqueduct. I had it in front of me as we talked. And that long New York Bred's Long on the Grass, always my favorite area of opportunity. And those are the right Master of the Tunes. I thought, in addition to My Lips Are Sealed, I thought it was one horse. The Donk horse, I thought, was maybe interesting. Lady Thornhill, 10-1. A little interested. But you need some pace to attack. We're going to talk probably some Keeneland Pick 4 with Seth as soon as he joins us. And it's, again, I mentioned this earlier, it's another deep, contentious, difficult Keeneland card with full fields and competitive assemblies. There's a maiden goes as the sixth, and there's actually a horse in the maiden race today. I'm curious about Seth's interests. 12-horse field, and they're going to go long on the dirt. And almost everybody has started. McPeak has got a firster, but otherwise everybody has run in here. So you're going to have horses, some stretching out, like Bill Maury's got on the rail, a Lee Gelding going from six to the mile in the eighth. You've got horses that have gone a mile coming out of a race that produced B minor. You got a lot of the horses that finished behind B minor, and frankly, it was a decent, came back, you know, decently fast. Cherie's got Presider, a Connect colt. Steve Asmussen has got an oddball in here, a Frosted for Winchell and Levinson, Permafrost, that Nick made 20 to 1. And I'm very interested if that 20 to 1 holds up. There's real reason to believe that Permafrost, this horse debuted at Kentucky Downs. And that may just have been, part fitness and part, let's just see what we've got here. But there was no reason to believe that Permafrost was going to be particularly good on the grass. And now comes to the main track. You know, 6.5 furlongs at Kentucky Downs is like, almost a mile race, essentially. This one's a half to Divine Oath and Auntie Joy, who were both stake horses and good going long on the dirt. I don't know why Permafrost isn't a play in here at 20 to 1. Seth Barrow, good morning.
I'm right with you. Before I get to that, though, I have to say, come on, Andy, come on. The guy's yawning, and then he's taking a pot shot at me. Come on. I yawn.
Listen, I just be happy you didn't have to deal with it all summer. Right? Did you hear him last week when he said, I think was it last week or the week before, he said that you never called him all summer.
I never
to be
called
on the show.
Because he never called. It was like 2 or 3 years. We used to have him on all the time, and then he got very well. They typically do the production meetings. In the morning. But I have been able to get some of the others on, but he's always like, I got the production meeting. I have the production meeting. So this summer I didn't ask him. Because he's always got the production meeting going. I mean, now he's in. If he's saying that on the radio, now he's committed for next summer.
Now he's in trouble.
I'm pulling that up and record, put it on my phone so I can play it for him.
Speaking of which, you, the editing whiz that you are a production genius. For those that didn't take part in my ridiculous offering of my Waze instructions that I recorded this winter, and I don't know why I waited this long to put the link up for people to download it to their Waze, but you seized the opportunity. Then you went and you took some audio bites from a show, and you slapped it on top of an Office episode and made it look like I directed Steve Carell into a pond.
I was trying to get Turn Right because Dino in the control room walks into the studio and says, well, did you see Steve's on Waze now? And he's playing it on his phone. It's like, Turn Right, Turn Left, Turn Right. I said, well, give me Turn Right. I need Turn Right for this. And then he couldn't get it back up. So I pulled up a couple of semi-appropriate pieces out of the radio show. But the clip went very well, when, as you said, it's not my fault. And then it zoomed in on the little map device. And, so it worked out. It worked out.
It was very funny. It made me laugh. That was very clever. Good job.
We try.
Didn't you have a big clubhouse, or where were you for for the OTB, the bankroll play.
Oh, the bankroll. Yeah, we did bankroll on Sunday. Worked out well. I was doing Belmont. I concentrated on Belmont at Aqueduct and Keeneland, and I have to say, Sunday I was just kind of whiffing at Belmont. I took a few swings there, but I did okay at Keeneland. It was a $300 bankroll, and we had 15 people playing. So I took the 300 and I turned it into, I think, 480, something like that. So it worked out okay. We hit the early pick four was very funny. I played against some favorites, some chalky favorites, and that's what helped it. But I wound up hitting the second choices in the first three legs. And then the favorite won the last leg. But as I say, there was some heavy chalk in those first three legs, and we got past those. It was an $18 ticket. I went one by whatever. So it was 3 second choices and a favorite. And for 50 cents, it paid $2.50. So that started things out nicely.
Nice.
And then, then we hit a couple others. We hit a nice triple a little bit later in the day. So everybody walked away with a little free money courtesy of Capital OTB. And I should mention, we have two huge bankrolls coming up, Breeders' Cup Day. There's going to be one for online Capital OTB people and one for people who come down to the clubhouse on that Saturday. They'll both be $2,000 that we'll be playing during the afternoon. I think each team is 40 people. So it should be fun. Hopefully, you know, you get the couple thousand dollars, you get to swing for the fences in a few spots. So it should be fun on Breeders' Cup Saturday.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to... in fact, you mentioned that. I should throw out that I've got to reach out to everybody and get everybody lined up for the third annual At the Races Breeders' Cup betting guide.
I thought of that the other day. Yeah, just thought.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, we'll pull that together, and I'll see what everybody, I'll remind myself what everybody did the last couple of years with their favorite races. And speaking of Breeders' Cup, by the way, and I think you may have been a filly and mare sprint analyst. Tough news out of Neil Pessin's barn and for Bob Lothenbach. Felt absolutely terrible, and they're not going to be able to run Belle's the One. She's got just a minor setback, but it's enough to miss some days, and she won't make Breeders' Cup. So she'll go into the sale, and she'll be selling at Knight of Stars. And so I hope for the Lothenbachs, I'm sure she'll sell well. But what a great job Neil did with Belle's the One.
Yeah, that's always, you feel for folks who, you know, have a nice horse and get that chance at the Breeders' Cup. And then, you know, every year they're in the weeks leading up, there's somebody who has to go to the sidelines for one reason or another. So unfortunate that worked out. She's been a lot of fun to watch, certainly down there in Kentucky. And yeah, unfortunate. Speaking of sales, I didn't hear the beginning of Andy's segment. Did Andy go over? I was trying to get over yesterday, and I couldn't make it over. It seems like it was a good sale there yesterday, though, the basic
Monday.
October
sale.
Sale
was good.
Yeah, Monday.
Went over the results with Sid, actually. We went over all the weanlings because there were some very intriguing numbers posted. The results were very strong. They were up 24%. But I was on my way, and I started to feel lousy, and then it ended up resulting in me having a scratch yesterday. So I did not go. Andy said the same thing. He ended up scratching as well, and he was visiting his mother, so he did not go to the sale Monday either.
Yeah, like I said, I was trying to get over, and I just was running around all day long, couldn't make it over. But it's always, it's a nice little, puts the period at the end of the sentence for the Saratoga racing season. I would like to go.
All right, let's put some periods and some zeros into this pick four at Keeneland. We got about 6 minutes.
Fifth race, we are looking at the allowance non-winners of one other than 5.5 on the grass. I have it 8, 7, 3, and 4, but I'll use the 8, 7, and the 3. Couple of speed horses in the mix with American Starlet and Laugh and Play. I think the Wesley Ward runner, American Starlet's probably the better of the two, and comes in off a little bit of a disappointing effort at Kentucky Downs, but the race before that at Saratoga was pretty good. So that's kind of more what I'm keying on. Laugh and Play also has a little bit of speed, so we'll see if one of those can kind of steal it. And if they don't, maybe Quarry a Comment coming in off a nice win at Kentucky Downs. Nice little closing effort. If the speed folds a little bit, maybe Quarry a Comment will be the one that picks up the pieces. So a couple of speed horses and one that comes from off the pace in the opening leg, 8, 7, and 3 in the fifth.
Yeah, I can see that. They all make sense. Get Serious moving to Wayne Mackey from Delacour. Kind of caught my eye a little bit. 8-1 if you're looking for a little price boost in the exotics. We started talking about the maiden race. I was as we were waiting for you, and at 20-1, Permafrost to me feels like a price key. Then there's some pretty obvious, straightforward favorites like Cyclone Mischief from Dale Romans, who's going to be the 9-5 favorite when they start the bidding, and then Presider, Cherie's horse, at 7-2.
Yeah, I have two prices bookending those two shorter prices. And I'm not sure, one of them is Permafrost and one of them is King D'Oro. I'll be interested to see. I'm not sure we'll get the price. I'm not saying we won't, but I'm wondering if folks will latch on to what you and I were both kind of talking about. You talked about the siblings to Permafrost and, the connections and whatnot, King D'Oro. We'll see, but I have it 7, 8, 6, and 4. I'll use all of those. I put King D'Oro on top. Medaglia D'Oro's a decent sire, win early types. This one worked a quick 10.1 and attracted just under a quarter of a million down at Ocala. And if you pull up that page, there's one racing sibling called Perpetuate that was second in the career debut, subsequently ran 6th and 7th, so kind of mixed messages there. But boy, you look down that page, there's a lot of black type there. Pretty close up on the page was Oxbow, a little further down, Tis Now, and a few other of those types are on the page. Went off as the favorite in the debut. I'm going to give this one another shot at a big price. So King D'Oro on top. Then I have Presider in the second slot. That one along with Cyclone Mischief, both coming off pretty good tries last time. They were 2nd and 3rd in the same race, and they were right next to each other. So I think they're both live, certainly in here, and will attract the attention. But as you mentioned, Permafrost, you mentioned just the two siblings I have written down. Divine Oath won the first two of that one's career. Auntie Joy won her career debut. This one didn't live up to that. We all know the Asmussen horses can improve second time out. And as you say, the first start was in one of those rich maiden races over Kentucky Downs on the grass. So this horse might be a little bit more interesting here going long on the dirt. So, again, I'll use all four of them. Maybe we can get a price. We'll see, again, how the odds shape up. But I have 7, 8, 6, and 4.
Seventh race, the nominal feature is a $140,000 conditional allowance and tight field of 7. And, in fact, dive into it, Seth, and I'm going to check the scratches. I hadn't looked, so let me check what's going on if there's any changes.
The 3 and the 4 are out of this one. Yes. I have a 5, 7, 6, and 1, but I'm going to use the 5, 7, and the 6. 12-1 for Heart Rhythm. Horse is 2 for 2 at Keeneland and does come out of a mediocre effort and was claimed out of that for 100K. Has some stakes competition down the page, and I think this is a decent little runner. I mean, you look and has earned almost $300,000, 15 in the money, finishes in 20 starts. But most importantly, 2 for 2 at Keeneland. And going back to the race at Keeneland just about this time last year, that was a pretty good effort where the horse stepped up nicely off the previous effort. So I kind of went back to that and thought, getting back to Keeneland and given what we saw about this time last year, I'll put that one on top, see if we can get a price there. Prevalence is clearly going to be the one to beat for Brendan Walsh. Bullet Workout coming into this, and there was certainly some class that this one has shown earlier in the career, but hasn't been seen since May. Chatelot also in the mix, also coming off a layup, and another one that has shown some talent for Asmussen with 4 wins and 7 starts. So again, I have the interesting horse at the price, and then a couple of horses that probably match up class-wise with this field pretty well, but have to overcome layoffs. So I'll go 5, 7, and 6 in the 7.
The one horse I'll mention that didn't come up is the 2, Hear My Song, that has run well at Keeneland, and that includes the Maiden Breaker going back to last fall.
So that always catches my attention. Hear my song, Across Traffic, Gelding, that last race, that race at Churchill, excuse me, going seven. That'll fit well for Bill Stinson. The eighth, Phillies and Mares, turf sprinting, 5.5.
I had it 9-11, 1-6, the 11 scratch, so I'm now 9-1-6, but I'll stick with the 9 and the 1. Opening buzz, Tyler Gaffleon on board, comes east off a couple of races most recently at Del Mar, one on the dirt, one on the turf, and in fact, overall, we've had a synthetic, a dirt, and a turf race, and the two wins were synthetic and turf, so I think the turf here this afternoon is going to be a bonus. And again, Gaffleon on board. But I'll also use Shannon for Brad Cox, coming off a nice try at Kentucky Downs last time. And as I said, the six was also in my mix. And you look at the first couple of races in the career, and they were pretty good. And I could make the case there. But the last race off a long layoff, you see a trouble line. It says veer out. If you go back and watch the race, clearly he did. Left from the, clearly she did, left from the outside post position. And did veer out, but then pretty quickly got back up into the running and then didn't show anything. I couldn't leave it out of the mix totally, but again, out of my handicapping mix, I'm not going to put it on the pick four ticket. I'm going to use the 9 and the 1.
So here's Seth's ticket, 3-7-8 with 4-7, 4-6-7-8 with 5-6-7 with 1-9, $36. 3-7-8 with 4-6-7-8 with 5-6-7 with 1-9. Seth Merrow, everybody. Seth Merrow 2 on your Twitter. Andy Serling earlier. Sid Fernando. Dick Powell.